Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. I hope you had a great weekend. So nice to have you back with us to start this Monday together, which means politics. I'll introduce our guests momentarily, but I also invite you to stay tuned later this hour as we look at Berkeley, the city whose council unanimously voted to ban natural gas being fed into new single-family homes, apartments, condos to be constructed in the city of Berkeley. We'll talk about the pros and cons of that. This is the first such ordinance anywhere in the United States. But joining us to talk politics is UCLA Professor of Political Science and Chicano Studies, Matt Barreto. He's co-founder of Latino Decisions, the research and polling firm. Also with us, Claremont McKenna College Professor of Politics, Jack Pitney. Jack, good morning. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
You just reminded me that you have former students running for president. I knew one of them, but you may be the only professor in the country with two former students running for president.
Yes. Steve Bullock, who's going to be on the debate stage in Democratic debate, Governor of Montana, was my student, as is Adam Kokesh, who is seeking the Libertarian Party nomination for president. And Adam's pledge is that as soon as he becomes president, he'll resign.
Buddy. Speaking of Libertarian Party, Justin Amash left the Republican Party. He's called for the impeachment of President Trump. He's been one of the few, I guess he's now former Republican, to call the president's tweets of last week against the squad racist. You think that Amash might well run as an independent or run in the Libertarian primary?
It's quite possible. He certainly has a great deal more public visibility than other people seeking the nomination, including Adam. The question for him is, where would he draw his votes? Would he draw his votes primarily from people who otherwise vote for Trump, or would he draw votes from the Democrats and thereby help Trump win a second term? And that's a very serious consideration for him.
All right. Matt, good to have you with us. Welcome back to the program. I wanted to begin with what we've seen in the fallout. We just heard on NPR News the back and forth continuing between the four members of the squad, the Fresh Women Democrats, who progressive, who the president tweeted against about going back to their countries of origin. And just wonder about, you know, the sort of the reverberations back and forth between them. And there have been a lot of attention to how this affects Trump. How do you think it affects the members of the squad?
Well, it's certainly very unpleasant for them. I mean, it's completely questioning not just their citizenship, but their commitment to America. Even in Trump's revised tweets and statements, he's now saying that, you know, they don't care about America. They're trying to undermine it. And I think some of them have tweeted publicly and also stated privately in some reports that is very hurtful, that it's creating a lot of, you know, stress and anxiety. And it's certainly uncalled for in what the president has done to these members of Congress. So that is something that I think does deserve more attention and we need to reflect on and think about. But obviously, they've been pushing back quite strongly. They've demonstrated their commitment to America, that the reason they ran for office and got elected was because they love this country and they want to try to make it better. There's nothing wrong with trying to always improve your democracy. And so I think that's going to be the message that comes out, not only from these four very strong women, but from many of the Democratic candidates, is that there's nothing wrong with wanting to improve and make things better. In fact, you know, in many ways, that was Trump's slogan. He was the one criticizing America 3.5 years ago when he started his campaign. And so hopefully the Democrats are able to get more Americans on their side. I think most of the polling has suggested most people, a majority of people, disagree with the way Trump has handled this. And it will be very interesting to see his next rally. So you saw the discussion with the vice president on the Sunday morning news shows. He suggested that the president is going to possibly, maybe, he might try to stop these chants, which historically, of course, Trump has never done. He's let the crowd just sort of chant wildly. So
we're talking about the send her back chants of the last rally.
That's exactly right. That's what I'm going to be watching and seeing, is whether or not there's any movement there. There's been a lot of contrast to the McCain-Obama election, when McCain at various times did interject and did stop audience members from using inflammatory or racist language. And certainly Trump has done the opposite.
So. Yeah, there was the very famous exchange between John McCain and the woman in the audience at one of his campaign rallies, who talked about President Obama being foreign born and not an American, and McCain correcting her. Jack, your thoughts about, because as hurtful as this might be for the four members of the squad, it does further raise their political profile.
Yeah, and for Democrats, as a crass political matter, there are both opportunities and liabilities. The opportunity is to energize the base of the Democratic Party, contributors, volunteers, and the rest. The question is whether they will define the Democratic Party in the eyes of the general public. That's a concern raised by some more moderate Democrats. However, important thing to remember is a lot of people in the political community are focusing on them. Not sure average American voters are defining the Democratic Party through the lens of the squad, or even if they have a clear idea of who these members of Congress are. We tend to assume sometimes that the public has more knowledge of politics than it really does. So I'd like to see some polling data on whether the general public does in fact think that these four junior members of Congress define the party as a whole.
One thing we do see, a brand new NPR Marist University poll that's come out, which shows that independent voters don't seem enamored of either President Trump or of Democrats. President Trump showing, and it's only marginal, probably within the margin of error, slightly the highest the lowest disapproval rating that President Trump has had, because that's sort of how you measure his presidency, by how unpopular. And Jack, your thoughts about whether there is a path for President Trump here?
Yeah, the thing about public approval is that it has been remarkably stable since the start of his presidency. It's twitched between the high 30s and the low 40s. If you compare it with other presidents, say George W. Bush, massive differences in approval rating over time. Not so with Trump. Does he have a path to reelection? Absolutely. He was able to get elected in 2016 with a minority of the vote, losing the popular vote by a substantial margin to Hillary Clinton. Could happen again, pretty much by carrying the same states. That could happen. Will it? Well, we'll see how it develops next year.
Yeah, and I'm curious, Matt, because you're a pollster as well as a professor. A New York Times upshot analysis says President Trump's Electoral College advantage may at this point be greater than 2016.
Well, yeah, it's interesting. I saw that analysis, and what they're looking at is whether or not he can squeak by in a number of these states, just as he did in places like Michigan and Pennsylvania. And there may be some other states where Trump is able to just barely win by 1%. And then he loses badly in places like California, New York, Illinois, and maybe even Texas gets very close and he holds on. So if that's the case, their analysis suggested that he could lose by as many as 5 million votes nationwide. And remember last time he lost by 3 million, but still win, maybe even pick up some new states. So I think that's the thing for folks to remember, is that as we transition and start talking about the presidential election, you really need to be looking at a state-by-state analysis. What is the polling in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Florida showing us?
Although
polling in Arizona showing us, and not looking at these national big picture polls, because they could be misleading.
Although presumably a Democratic nominee would not do as Hillary Clinton's campaign did, avoid some of those states where it was so close.
Well, I think you're definitely going to see the Democrats take a different approach. First of all, competing very heavily in those upper Midwest states, but also, you know, putting more energy and putting more attention to polling in those states. That was one of the criticisms, is that there wasn't enough information being drawn from Wisconsin and Michigan to fully understand how close they were, in fact, that they were being lost. So I think you will see the Democrats pay more attention there, but Trump still maintains an advantage in places like Ohio and maybe even Iowa. And so those states will be critical to see exactly what the margin is. But the analysis from the Upshot and others suggested that, you know, these national polls might be making us feel that Trump is losing when we look at his approval rating being underwater. But those are national polls, and that's really impacted by very unpopular sentiment in California here, as well as other large populated states like New York and Illinois, where he's very, very unpopular. Well, whether he loses those states 99-1 or 51-49, he doesn't get any of the Electoral College votes. So it doesn't change the outcome. Mm-hmm. If Californians dislike him even more, he still isn't going to win any of our Electoral College votes. So I'm starting to look closely at state-by-state analysis. It's early, but I encourage listeners to do the same and really try to get a feel of how things are going to shape up in 2020.
Matt Barreto, UCLA Professor of Political Science. Jack Pitney, Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, it's still unclear to me how big the economy is going to play into this, because the economy is roaring. And the polls, like the NPR Marist poll, indicate that people feel good about the economy, general large majorities. At the same time, that doesn't seem to be accruing to President Trump. But if the economy starts slowing down or turns, will that accrue to the president?
Probably. This is an area where political scientists have had to take a second look at a lot of their assumptions over time. In a normal presidency, Trump's approval rating would be considerably higher than it is. The economy is really doing good, and people generally give the president at least some credit for that. But one thing we can probably count on is that a bad economy is going to be bad for the incumbent administration. If there is a recession, the incumbent party is going to take a hit. The Democrats did in 1980, for instance. It wasn't because Ronald Reagan had a silver tongue. It's because the economy was going downhill. And if there is a recession next year, that will hurt Trump. And that's one reason why he's so paranoid about the Federal Reserve. He keeps talking about interest rates. It's very much in his interest to keep heating up the economy in hopes of maintaining the economic expansion through 2020. What happens after that? He's less concerned.
The NPR Marist poll also looked at some of the issues on which Democratic candidates are running. Jack, so-called Medicare for All has majority support, but if that meant doing away with private insurance, you see a big drop-off in support for that. The public very split on the issue of free college tuition at public colleges and universities, carbon-based fuels, their number of other issues, providing health care benefits for undocumented people, low approval for that. Though, is it going to be possible for a Democratic candidate to run on some of these highly progressive platforms, win on that in the primary, and then back away from that in the general?
That would be very difficult. On health care, the Kaiser Family Foundation has polling showing that Americans are generally not that dissatisfied with their own private health insurance. Mayor de Blasio made a joke of it at the last debate, but in fact, people generally are okay. They're not enthusiastic, if you've ever dealt with medical bills, but they're okay with it. And there's a phenomenon called loss aversion. People don't like to lose what they have. That's one reason why Obamacare was initially very unpopular, and it became popular once it became the status quo. So Medicare for All initially sounds great because people are familiar with Medicare, and it sounds just like an expansion of something that's in place. But if it involves depriving people of something they have and are okay with, that's a different story politically, and that's something the Democrats are going to have to watch out for.
Or the other thing, not necessarily deprived, but you could see where the premiums for the private insurers go up because Medicare has lower reimbursement rates, and so that has a ripple effect on people who get insurance through their employers.
Yeah, and Democrats really need to think through the implications of what they're proposing, because the Republican opposition researchers are definitely going to be thinking through these things.
We'll continue our conversation with Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College, Matt Barreto of UCLA. It's Air Talk. It's our weekly politics roundup. We'll more conversation about the 2020 Democratic candidates. They've got back-to-back nights of debate next week on CNN. We'll also talk about the new plan for Wall Street from Senator Elizabeth Warren and the Trump campaign's newest offering, plastic straws. That's their new swag. We'll be back with more in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're receiving news reports the FBI serving search warrant at the offices of the L.A. Department of Water and Power in downtown L.A. We have no further details, but as we get them, of course, we'll be bringing them to you right here on 89.3 KPECC. Also want to remind you, we'll be bringing you live coverage Wednesday of Bob Mueller's testimony before two congressional committees. You'll hear that NPR coverage live right here on 89.3 KPECC. Right now, we're talking politics with Jack Pitney of Claremont McKenna College, where he's professor of politics, and Matt Barreto, UCLA professor of political science. He's also co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. Well, let's look at the 2020 candidates so far. And Matt, your sense of sort of who seems to be picking up some steam and who seems to be paddling in place.
Yeah, I think the first debates in Miami of a few weeks ago were very helpful. They were hard for the people to get a word in because there were 20 of them, but they served their purpose. There was a couple of folks like California Senator Kamala Harris, who by all evaluations had a good night, scored some points, and has seen her stock rise. Elizabeth Warren also had a good performance, seeing this, that her stock is on the rise. And some outsiders, some ones that were a little bit lower down, folks like Secretary Julian Castro, scored a few points in his debate with Beto O'Rourke. So you saw a couple of people come up. There were some other folks, some of the ones who were further out on the margins, out on the wings of that debate stage, who did not do as expected or perhaps didn't improve. And so you're going to start seeing, I think, over the next coming weeks, especially after the next debate, if they don't turn things around, you're going to start to see the field start to narrow down. And then you have some of the big names like Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Sanders. And they were sort of, I think, both in the middle. They sort of held their own. They didn't have any super strong breakout moments. And they're still there at the top of the tier, at the top of the pack in that running. So I thought it was good. I thought it was good for the debate. It brought those voices together. And we're starting to see some movement. We're starting to see the media as well as voters dig in and pay closer attention to the candidates, and that's what the debates will help us do.
Mm-hmm. Jack, your sense of that, and just one observation. Before Donald Trump, I always thought, a successful candidate for president had to have a little bit of a self-deprecating ability. You know, the previous Obama would make jokes at his expense, and George W. Bush, and I mean, going back to, before Ronald Reagan, that was sort of a stock, sort of how you made yourself more human. Donald Trump sort of flipped that, and many of the Democratic candidates seem very serious. It's hard to imagine them sort of engaging in Obama-like self-deprecation. Does that matter anymore?
It's a good question. The trouble for Democratic candidates is that they may look at Donald Trump and see, well, it worked for him. And so a much more aggressive approach, a humorless approach might be appealing to the voters. Not sure that is the best way to go about it. Trump has his specific constituency. But I think for the remaining portion of the electorate in both parties, something like the approach of Barack Obama or John Kennedy, not quite so serious about oneself. That's probably still the best way to go.
Yeah. Matt, what do you think?
I think that voters are looking for that stability. And I think voters are looking more for that unity right now. And so while Trump is going to continue to play the sort of attack dog and making jokes and making fun of people, I think there's an opportunity for the Democratic candidates to sort of emerge perhaps a little bit more in the Barack Obama mold, and to try to chart out a course where they look like the ones who are the adults in the room, who are being more civil and who are trying to bring the country together. If they can do that while also proposing their policy agenda, I think that's probably the best prescription for challenging Trump and taking Trump on, really challenging him on his demeanor Because it was one thing in 2016 when it was a little bit more of a joke, when he wasn't in office. Now we get the sense, and the 2018 election results may have suggested this, that voters don't really like to see that meanness, that mean-spiritedness in practice, meaning in his actual policies and in his public office. So I think that's where there's an opportunity for the Democrats.
All right. We're talking with Matt Barreto, joining us, UCLA professor of political science, Jack Pitney professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Joe Biden had what was generally viewed as a poor performance in the first debate. He, by his own admission, he wasn't prepared when Senator Harris questioned him about past policies on busing, as well as his comments about being willing to work with segregationists earlier in the Senate. Jack, how important is next week's debate for Biden?
Very important. And debates matter a great deal more in the nomination phase than the general election phase. Trump lost all the debates in the fall of 2016. Didn't matter. He still won the election. But this time out, we've seen in the past somebody like Rick Perry had his oops moment that was very damaging to him. And at very least, Biden has to avoid another YouTube moment where he doesn't seem to be in command of the issues. Preferably, he should come across as strong and well prepared. Trouble is, this is Joe Biden. He does not have a great record at that. Self-discipline on the stage is not necessarily a strong suit. The man has a great, has a large number of virtues, but that isn't at the top of it. So that's something to watch.
Well, and we heard word that some of the members of the prep team weren't all that happy because they felt he wasn't really taking advice and doing the stuff you need to do to prep.
Yeah. And Joe Biden's selling point is authenticity. He's still the same guy who rides the train to work as he was in the 1970s. And there's a great deal of appeal to that. But the downside is that very often when he is in these public settings, he says things that aren't necessarily to his own advantage.
Matt, Bernie Sanders campaign workers are demanding a minimum wage of $15 an hour. There have been reports that the campaign might do that and cut hours at the same time. Is this damaging potentially in the primary for Sanders that compensations become an issue?
I don't think where they are right now is damaging. It could potentially get there if the negotiations break down and they can't come to a resolution, but it doesn't seem to be the case. In his statements, Senator Sanders said that they're, you know, negotiating in good faith and that this is how negotiations work, that people make demands and that you respond. And so given all of his public support for workers and workers' unions and wages, I would expect that if anything, the Sanders campaign is able to sort of turn this around and say, look, we had complaints. We addressed those. We want to make sure all of our campaign staff are making a living wage. And we encourage other campaigns to do that. So he has an opportunity because he is on the right side of the issue, given all of his public statements, he has an opportunity to win on this issue. Now, at the same time, if he doesn't handle it well, if ego gets involved and for whatever reason they can't resolve it, then I think it'll be sort of nipping at his heels. It'll be something that other candidates can criticize him on, and it'll just look like he's not walking the walk. So yeah. At this point, though, it looks like he is probably heading in the right direction. It looks like he'll probably resolve this favorably with his staff.
My ignorance is such, it never occurred to me that campaigns would have minimum wage workers. I assumed they had more highly paid experts who worked, you know, that was their job. They went from campaign to campaign. And then the rest were sort of part-time volunteers or, you know, summer college student people like that. Jack, I didn't even know that campaigns had whole teams of minimum wage workers.
It varies. In the campaigns I was involved in back when I was involved with the Republican Party, a lot of the work was done for free. But the downside to the Democrats is they try to adhere to the law in that. And that gets them in trouble when, in the case of Sanders, the workers put in many more hours than would normally be the case. And that really is typical of campaigns. You don't work a 40-hour week in a presidential campaign, more like 80.
All right. Matt, just anything to add to that about the use of minimum wage workers? Is that, to your knowledge, pretty common these days?
Well, I think it is something that's new. It's a transition. It had been almost entirely volunteer force for those lower skilled and lesser glamorous jobs. But there's been a movement to, you know, pay all interns a minimum wage. And there's been a movement in D.C. to stop having free interns because that just benefits high income, upper class students who can afford to take the summer off and work on a campaign or work in a congressperson's office. And so Democrats have been, including Warren and Castro and many others, saying we're going to pay all of our interns. We're not going to have these free interns. And not only are we going to pay them, but we're going to pay them $15 because that's part of this movement. So it's something that's newer this year in 2020. We're seeing way more of it than we have seen in previous cycles. And Sanders has been a part of that. He has been part of that $15 minimum wage push. And so I think it's coming back now with those questions. I mean, it is great that they're actually paying their workers and not relying on free work on the evenings and weekends for this door knocking and canvassing. But they do need to get it right then. They need to say, hey, if we're going to pay them and we believe in a living wage, we're going to actually do that.
So, I just wonder, though, if there's a difference in effect, Matt. If someone knocking at your door, you know, is being paid $15 an hour to do it versus someone who so believes in the candidate, they're doing it for free. Does that have a different effect on the voter?
Well, there actually have been some academic studies where they randomize that and people are either paid or they're volunteer. And then they also reveal sometimes to the person they're canvassing that they're either paid or that they're a volunteer. And it can have those effects. There is a little bit more sincerity and authenticity when you see that. The problem is that you need thousands and thousands of people hours in order to get that done. And it's very difficult, even with your strongest supporters. When they're out there doing that work, we should be paying them for the labor that they are giving us back. And I think that's where Democrats are coming to and saying, if I have all these supporters, even if they are enthusiastic, they're not mercenaries that are just saying, hey, I want $15 an hour, I'll read a script. I mean, these are traditionally very strong supporters to begin with. Well, the idea is let's pay you for the labor that you're actually.
Sure. Is the logical extension of that then that Democrats don't believe in volunteerism, that every labor should be paid?
Well, I don't know. I think that's a reasonable question. Maybe it'll come up in the
like churches or synagogue work or, you know, my mother puts in incredible hours at the VA. And I mean, that everything should be paid. Jack, is that, have you read of this?
I don't think it would go that far, and it would be very unwise for Democrats to talk about volunteer work for nonprofit organizations. That's something that's been very characteristic of the country since the early days. But when it comes to campaign work, again, they have a dilemma. On the one hand, they want to be seen to be adhering to the minimum wage. On the other hand, they're finding it's very difficult to run a campaign that way.
That's interesting because I thought of campaigns more like a nonprofit than like a standard job. Gentlemen, good to talk with you again. We appreciate it. We'll look forward to speaking with you soon. Jack Pitney, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College, and Matt Barreto, UCLA, professor of political science and Chicano studies, also co-founder of the research and polling firm Latino Decisions. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. The Berkeley City Council unanimously voted to ban natural gas being piped into new houses, condominiums, apartment buildings. We'll talk about the potential costs, drawbacks, and the pluses environmentally right after this live update.